Radio Prague News.
Czech politicians have congratulated Austria's president-elect. A new poll has suggested that trust in the head of state is at its lowest point this year. And the broadcaster CNN has included Prague on the list of cities with the best Christmas markets. Senior Czech politicians have congratulated Alexander van der Bellen on his win of the presidential election in neighboring Austria. Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka, Foreign Minister Lubomír Zaorálek, and others in the government, as well as in the opposition, such as Topo 9 leader Miroslav Kalousek, were among those who wished Mr. van der Bellen well following his victory Sunday over the far-right candidate Norbert Hofer. And speaking of presidency's trust in the countries, in the Czech president Miloš Zeman is the lowest all year according to a poll conducted by the CVVM agency. According to the survey, trust in the head of state fell by 8% in November to an overall 48%. That drop coincided with a scandal in late October in which Czech-born Auschwitz survivor Jiří Brady was allegedly passed over for a state honor as the result of a meeting between his uncle, Culture Minister Daniel Herman, and Tibetan spiritual leader the Dalai Lama. Distrust in the president, according to the same poll, meanwhile, is 49%. Personnel of a 17-member strong field surgical team departed for Iraq shortly after midnight on Monday, where they will join coalition Iraqi and U.S. soldiers providing support at a U.S. base several dozen kilometers away from Mosul. The news was confirmed by the spokesman for the general staff of the Czech Armed Forces, Jan Scholz. Two surgeons and an anesthesiologist form the core of the field hospital group. Investment in new military equipment by the Czech Army over the period of the last 5 years was marred by shortcomings in project outlines and planning, the country's Supreme Audit Office has found. According to the audit, the Army's fighting capabilities have nevertheless improved through most of the purchases. Details of the audit were released on Monday by the Supreme Audit Office's Olga Malkova. The country's defense ministry considers important the fact that the Bureau found no breach of the law or of ministry regulations. The ministry, meanwhile, has also announced that it is working on simplifying and speeding up the process of army acquisitions. Broadcaster CNN has included Prague's Christmas markets on a list of the 10 best in the world, citing traditional markets on the city's old town as well as Wenceslas Squares. The article rated favorably Czech beer and sausages as well as the opening times at both markets, saying they remained open throughout the Christmas period. Other markets included in the article included ones in Vienna, Venice, or Copenhagen. The only North American Christmas market to make the list was Montreal's. Some 17 children at a hospital ward in Karlovy Vary were visited by fourth-year high school medical students on Monday, dressed as angels, devils, and Mikuláš, or St. Nicholas, to mark the upcoming Saint's Day. Events marking Mikuláš are traditionally held on the evening of December the 5th. Traditionally, children receive fruit or chocolate in return for reciting poems or singing songs, which keep the devils at bay. Somewhat naughty children can also receive a potato or a lump of coal. In recent years, more and more Czech children have themselves dressed up as the iconic characters, making the evening a little more like Halloween. I'm Jan Willinger. You'll find more news at radio.cz.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, the Czech Republic's gas pipeline company is challenging cuts imposed by the regulator, and the Czech music world mourns the loss of rock guitarist Radim Hladík. Later on, we meet Dr. Jarka Heisingerová, a leading Czech eye doctor who says her own temporary blindness as a teenager drew her to the field. Stay with us. Regulators and their subject companies are not supposed to be on the best of terms, but the latest price moves by the Czech energy regulator have clearly angered the country's main gas pipeline company, with a long, drawn-out legal battle now looming, Chris Johnston reports.
In European gas transit terms, the Czech Republic is in a comfortable position of being on some of the main transport routes for Russian natural gas to be shipped towards its major West European markets. It has two major cards in its hand, the traditional east-west gas pipeline through Slovakia, Ukraine, and to the Soviet gas fields constructed during the Soviet Union. And there's the new link under the Baltic Sea, Nord Stream, which cuts through northeast Germany and then the Czech Republic onto the major markets in Germany and the rest of Western Europe. And it's no secret that Russia would like to boost the Nord Stream shipments, which avoid Ukraine and deprive Kiev of potential massive gas transit earnings, even to the extent of building a second undersea gas pipeline. But shifting the shipments to Nord Stream would also hit Slovakia and its partly Czech-owned gas pipeline company EUStream, and would also threaten to leave the Czech gas pipeline company Net for Gas with an underused aging piece of infrastructure, which still needs to be paid for and maintained. And it's in that context, and the fact that some of Net for Gas's long-term gas transit contracts expire on or around 2018, that the Czech regulator has moved to cut some of the company's gas shipping charges. It argues that the existing charges are a lot higher than those in neighbouring countries, and that the costs will bring them into line. The regulator's broader strategic spin is that these cuts will also guarantee the long-term use of the main east-west pipeline. Net for Gas does not agree with most of what the regulator argues in its press release of December the 1st, giving the reasons for the cuts. It says the moves, which it describes as drastic, to take effect in 2017, average out at about more than 20% cuts compared with those in effect now. And it argues that this is an unprecedented and irregular move by the regulator, which will damage the Czech Republic in the short and long term. And Net for Gas says it will now take legal action to challenge the price rulings, which the gas pipeline company argues should improve the regulatory framework in the Czech Republic long term. The legal challenge is likely to be drawn out, but if victorious, the company has the prospect of clawing back the extra charges paid in the meantime. The overall atmosphere for foreign-owned utilities is not that positive in the Czech Republic, with the government recently releasing a detailed economic analysis, essentially charging them with expatriating a large amount of their profits and suggesting that tougher regulatory rules might be called for. Net for Gas and its Polish counterpart are a case in point at the moment, both dragging their feet on part of a north-south pipeline which was at one stage seen by both countries as a strategic priority.
Chris Johnson with that report. Now, sad news came over the weekend. Celebrated Czech rock guitarist Radim Hladík died just a few days short of his 70th birthday. He had been battling pulmonary fibrosis for a number of years and passed away on Sunday morning. Leading figures in the Czech music world have been paying tribute to the beloved musician. Dominic Yoon reports.
Radim Hladík is considered to be one of the greatest Czech rock guitarists of all time. His accomplished lead guitar skills evocative of the likes of Eric Clapton. In 2013, he spoke with Radio Prague and reflected on the musicians which had inspired him.
Nejvíc mě ovlivnil Jimi Hendrix, ten mi ukázal svobodu muzice, že vlastně...
The person who influenced me most was Jimi Hendrix. He showed me freedom. For me, music equals freedom. I can't stand clichés. Apart from maybe two songs, every time I play, I improvise. The freedom within the music is terribly inspiring, and that's why I still enjoy it.
The Czech rock band Blue Effect, with whom Radim Hladík played since 1968, featured countless members over its almost 50 years of existence. Radim Hladík was one of its founding members and the only original musician who remained with the group as it continued to perform for audiences as late as this October. The Prague musician studied classical guitar playing as a youngster, joining his first band Komety in 1963 at the tender age of 15. Hladík found his first success as a musician playing for the Matadors, a Czechoslovak rock group riding the late 1960s cultural explosion. Hladík left the group after the Soviet invasion in August 1968, soon joining Blue Effect along with bass player Jiří Kozel, guitarist and singer Vladimír Mišík and drummer Vlado Čech. The normalization era meant the band was forced to use the Czech equivalent name of Modrý Efekt. In 2013, Hladík explained to Radio Prague the meaning behind the band's name, a special document exempting men from mandatory military service.
Ta první sestava, která vznikla v roce 68, jsme měli všichni modré knížky.
In the first lineup in 1968, all of us had blue books. That meant we were safe from having to go into the army for 2 years. We all said it meant that we had 2 more years than everybody else.
Brali, že máme 2 roky navíc oproti ostatním.
The band's first studio album was issued in 1970, called Meditace. More than half of the songs were either written or co-written by Hladík. A total of 9 studio albums were issued by the group, as well as a number of live albums. Hladík also released albums collaborating with other artists, for example, 1996's Voliera, an experimental work with Czech female guitarist and composer Dagmar Andrtová-Voňková. Blue Effect itself was disbanded in 1990, but was revived again in 2004, with Radim Hladík embarking on a busy touring schedule well into his 60s. Figures across the Czech cultural scene have been paying tribute to the late guitarist. Czech rock singer Michal Prokop described Hladík as one of the greatest figures of Czech music, adding that he remained a warm and down-to-earth person. The Czech Ministry of Culture has also reacted, noting on its Twitter page that the loss of Radim Hladík will be felt by the entire Czech cultural scene.
Reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's now time for our regular Monday sports roundup.
Thank you, Daniela. In March, the Czech Republic's Gabriela Koukalová won the Crystal Globe for coming first in the season-long Biathlon World Cup. The 27-year-old has 2 silver medals from the Olympics and a gold in the mixed relay at the Biathlon World Championships and must be considered one of the favourites to take the Crystal Globe again this time out. However, Koukalová had a difficult summer when, exhausted after a tough season, she considered quitting the sport. Nevertheless, it's taken her only 2 rounds of this season's Biathlon World Cup to top the podium, after she came first in the pursuit in Sweden's Östersund on Sunday. Speaking afterwards, she said she was more surprised than anyone and recalled a summer filled with doubt.
Even
the biggest optimist probably wouldn't have expected this. I don't think any of my coaches expected it either. It was as if all my ambitions, my ideals just disintegrated. Suddenly I couldn't see any reason to compete and what the meaning of it all was.
But the Biathlon star, whose previous successes were achieved under her rather similar maiden name of Gabriela Soukalová, said she was inspired to continue by fans.
For me, it was really gratifying that many ill people or people who had had some family tragedy or even small children wrote saying they supported me. They said I gave them motivation for life, which I think is the greatest thing a person can achieve or that they can give to fans and to people.
Gabriela Koukalová. Football, and in the final round of the Czech season before the winter break, second-placed Slavia Prague notched up an impressive 4-0 away win over Zlín at the weekend. 2 of those strikes came from Czech international Milan Škoda, while Muris Mešanović and Jaromír Zmurhal each found the net once. Slavia city rival Sparta Prague are 3 points behind them in third after a 2-0 victory over Teplice in the capital. Meanwhile, Viktoria Pilsen go into the break as winter champions, despite having played 1 game fewer. Their match at Bohemians 1905 was abandoned due to the pitch being frozen. Senior league officials are to look into the matter after Bohemians were accused of not turning on the underground heating at their stadium in time. Finally, the young Czech striker Patrik Schick has done it again for Sampdoria. After scoring against Juventus on his league debut and then twice in the Italian Cup last week, the 20-year-old found the net again after coming on as a substitute in Sampdoria's 2-0 win over Torino on Sunday. That's all the sports news for today.
Well, that was the sports roundup, and now it's time for our main feature today. Dr. Jarka Hajsigerová is one of the leading figures in her field, both in the Czech Republic and at the international level. Her specialization is a rare but very dangerous condition, and she discusses it and much more with Ian Willoughby in this edition of One on One.
Jarka Hajsigerová is an internationally recognized expert on uveitis, a rare, hard-to-diagnose, and potentially blinding eye condition. The doctor, who spent a number of years studying and working in Scotland, switched her focus to the disease after previously specializing in the incredibly complex procedure of corneal transplantation. Our conversation took in those fields, and eye care in general. But I first asked Dr. Hajsigerová what had inspired her to become an ophthalmologist.
The very first thing which drew me to eyes might have been my own experience with blindness, because when I was very young, 16, I actually lost vision in one eye, and for several months I couldn't see at all with one eye, but suddenly this vision came back, and since I see very well. So when I started to study medicine, this might have been actually the very original idea why. And when in the fifth year we started to study ophthalmology, funny enough, it was the very first day when I fallen in love with ophthalmology, and I never fallen out of love. Ophthalmology is a fantastic field which covers everything in medicine. It covers inflammation, covers surgery, it covers plastic things like skin procedures, it covers tumors, it covers everything simply. You find everything. Anything you like, you find in ophthalmology, and it's so delicate, and it's just fantastic field.
Before we move on, I have to ask you, what actually happened to you? How did you go blind? Do you know what happened?
There is a very specific disease. It's a disease of the yellow spot, which is the major part of the retina with which you see. And in young women, this actually sometimes happens and is a thing which is not explained why at all, but it occurs. It doesn't leave anything in your eye, but for a certain period of time, like for weeks or months, you simply lose your central vision and it comes back, and nobody can explain.
We had a professor at university who claimed, I don't know if this is true, that Charles Darwin said that the eye could not have evolved, that it was so perfect. Whether it's true or not, the eye is an incredibly complex organ. Is it the most complex, would you say?
It might be, but actually our eye is not quite as well developed as some scientists say, because the light in our eye actually has to go through the retina to touch the sensitive parts and then goes back through the nerves and to the brain. Some people actually say that our brain evolved so well just because we needed some good PC or some good computer to process the very not as good signal which it gets. So our brain probably evolved just because of our not as geniusly designed eye.
Tell us, Jarka, you went for some years to Scotland. What brought you to Scotland and what did you do there?
I was sent there, actually, originally. I have started my PhD studies at the Charles University Ophthalmology Department. And I have been sent there for 1 year to have the international experience, and actually I have been doing a very, very difficult procedure at that time, very difficult surgical procedure, which was a corneal transplantation in an experimental model. So the cornea was only 2 millimeters in diameter, and I was putting 12 stitches around it under the microscope. And that was a technique which at that time knew just very few people around the world. So I have been sent to the department in Scotland, in Aberdeen, to continue with the research there because they needed somebody who would be able to do this surgical technique. So I did PhD there for about a year, and I stayed slightly longer. And I met this professor there who led me in my PhD. It was Professor Forrester in University of Aberdeen. And he actually, from the corneal transplantation, showed me another fascinating field, and that was the field of uveitis, which is a very special intraocular inflammation, very damaging, but quite fascinating. And he is a world expert in uveitis. So I came back from my PhD to finish it here in Charles University. And 2 years later, I've been called back to Aberdeen to spend another 2 years of clinical and basic research in another field, in this uveitis field.
Getting back briefly to this kind of surgery, corneal transplantation, when you speak about the tiny scale, what kind of instruments are you using to do that?
We use the very special ophthalmic instruments for ophthalmic surgery. Incredibly tiny instruments have been developed. And for this corneal transplantation, the most tiny have been used, even the most tiny stitches, of course, the needles. And that was in microns, really, the thickness of the thread and of the needle.
But are you doing it yourself in a hands-on way? Or are you directing some machine?
No. It was my hands who did it. And under the operating microscope, it did not look so tiny. So under the microscope, when you finally got the coordination right, you could do that.
Your specialization now, as you were saying, is uveitis, which is an inflammation of the uvea, if I'm right, which is the layer between the retina and the outer layer of the eye. How common is uveitis and how does it manifest itself?
Luckily, it's very rare. It's mostly like in half of the patients, luckily in the iris. So it's called anterior uveitis or iritis or iridocyclitis. And this type of uveitis, it's very painful. It brings, luckily, the patient immediately to the doctor, and it's very nicely cured with eye drops. So this is the sort of better type. Even the patient is suffering on the very beginning. The pain itself is actually an advantage because there is another half of the cases where it can be not painful at all, and it can very gradually and insidiously actually lose the vision of the patient. These cases very often can be therefore sight-threatening and needs to be treated with systemic treatment. The difficulty in uveitis is that we never on the first sight, or almost never on the first sight, are sure if it's infectious, if it's virus, bacteria, or mycosis which is causing it, or if it's autoimmune. If it's autoimmune, you have to use immunosuppressive treatment, so to suppress the immune system of the patient. However, if it's infectious, you need to use specialized antibiotics or virostatics, and these two treatments actually go against each other. So if you do not make correct diagnosis, you immunosuppress patient who's got virus in his body, and you actually suppress the last immunity he's got and he needs to fight the virus. It's quite serious thing to make a correct diagnosis, and as it is quite rare, there are not many doctors who are experienced enough with this disease. There are just a very few centers in the Republic who concentrate on this disease. As it is rare, the biggest center I can for sure say is in our hospital at the Charles University. We've got 5 doctors very specialized in uveitis, and I can vote for them that they will see the patient and they really very most time make the correct diagnosis.
If we could speak more generally about eye care, is there anything that people typically do wrong when it comes to looking after their eyes?
Taking care about the eyes is actually the same like taking care about the whole of the body. You should eat well enough, to have enough vitamins, to have enough other antioxidants and minerals. And all these are like little stones which build your good vision, because they help the metabolism of the retina simply to work well enough. Next to the good food, there is also very important good lifestyle. You need to be active enough to have healthy eyes. To be honest, not as recent, but quite just very few years ago, there was a large study which showed that actually 2 hours spent outside are a great prevention of myopia, which is short-sightedness, in children. Because this is a big problem in mostly in China, Singapore. Children are getting very myopic very early in their life, and nobody knew what's causing it. And it's probably is not as closely linked to tablets and PDAs and mobile phones as it is thought, but more people spending time inside than outside their
homes. So they
don't
see long distances.
That's exactly, it. Exactly. The eye is actually trained just for middle and short sight. And the retina gets from what's mostly used, gets signal, yeah, we need this short sight, let's make it better. So the eye is very clever, the nature is very clever. We need this, let's get it to the eye. But it's actually damaging for the children, for everybody. So even for adults now, they should take care not to, well, I wouldn't say not to read too much, but to take care to look to the far, really outside, out of the window, and to swap between short and long distances.
Well, this leads to my next question, which is, I remember years ago, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when everyone started using computers all the time, we got this advice, take a break, look away for 5 minutes, leave your screen. But nobody says that anymore. Am I right?
You are right. And it's actually even more important now, as it became a lifestyle to look to your smartphone. If you look in the public transport, everybody's looking into their mobile phones or tablets, and people are therefore really changing their vision, and they are changing it for the future. It's like Darwin's theory. So people in general will need only short sight. Let's change it. The nature is very clever and will get it back to us if we want it.
I feel like I'm kind of abusing you with very general questions now. But one question I have about eyes, are cheap sunglasses dangerous?
This is a very good question, because there's many sales which are dangerous, because there are many sunglasses which are only dark, but they do not have the specific UV filters they should have. There always should be a UV sign, UV certificate on the sunglasses, so you shouldn't really... To be honest, you shouldn't really use the very cheap sunglasses, which you do not know where they come from and if they are really protective, if they are not only sort of browned.
Eye specialist Dr. Jarka Hajsigerová was Ian Willoughby's guest on this edition of One on One, and I'm afraid it's brought us to the end of today's programme from Prague. You'll find us online at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then please write to english@radio.cz. And of course, you can always join us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today, and take care.